Coming up on this week's Book Show, Lydia Davis is a writer whose originality, influence, and wit are beyond compare. Best known for her masterful short stories and translations, her gifts extend equally to her nonfiction. In the new collection, Essays One, Davis has, for the first time, gathered a selection of essays, commentaries, and lectures composed over the past five decades. Lydia Davis, on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Lydia Davis is a writer whose originality, influence, and wit are beyond compare. Jonathan Franzen has called her a magician of self-consciousness, while Rick Moody hails her as the best prose stylist in America. Best known for her masterful short stories and translations, Davis's gifts extend equally to her nonfiction. In the new collection, Essays One, Davis has, for the first time, gathered a selection of essays, commentaries, and lectures composed over the past five decades. In this first of two volumes, her subjects range from her earliest influences to her favorite short stories, from John Ashbery's translation of Rimbaud to The Shepherd's Psalm to early tourist photographs. Lydia Davis's new collection is Essays One, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Lydia Davis to this week's Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
It's a great pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
I assume, given the celebration over the collection of short stories, that it wasn't long after that that people approached you and said, let's put the essays together.
Well, in fact, it was a little different, and I'm going to have to search my mind for exactly how it happened. It didn't come from someone else. It came from me just looking at the pile by now, really, because this is going to be two volumes. Here's one, there'll be another. A pile of introductions, talks, forewords, and so on, and thinking, well, it's about time to sort through some of this and begin putting it out there in book form. So that's what I started doing.
What becomes your job then? I mean, is it very much a curator editorial job?
It is. I mean, first I have to decide what goes in and what stays out, and that's not easy either. And then I start reading through each essay. That's the way it happened with this book anyway. Reading through each one and really doing editorial work and also making that difficult decision, you know, should I do a lot of revising or should I just leave something the way it is that I wrote in 1985 or 1995.
What is it like to revise something that you've written perhaps decades ago?
Oh, it's a curious experience because most of these I don't reread, so it's like meeting my younger self and saying, well, you were a little bit naive to say that, weren't you? Or, yes, right on, I still agree with you. So it's a strange double personality kind of thing.
Are there times where you just wanted to leave it be? To have it stand for what it stood for when it was originally published?
Actually, most of the time, I really did just let it stand. I think there was only one thing I would have corrected, but I didn't include that review in the book, so it didn't become an issue. Most of the time, I agreed with myself. So it was a matter of small writing tweaks, you know, a comma in or out or something a little bit clearer.
When you look and you start to read your work again, is that a comfortable act for you? I've heard many writers say that that's actors too. They don't want to see their work. They don't want to read their work. what is your comfort level with that?
It's actually pretty good because I'm a really meticulous about what I finish and put out there in the world. If I think it's lame, I really just don't publish it. So each thing, even though these started when I was a good deal younger, each piece of writing I was very, very scrupulous about reading over and over. So I'm not uncomfortable. And I've sometimes argued with writers who say, oh, well, that's my early work. And I think, don't discount your early work, you know, stand up for it.
The pile that started to get larger and larger that you talked about before comes, I guess, out of a lot of introductions, as you mentioned. You write an awful lot in here about writers and writing.
Yes, there's obviously that's going to be a big preoccupation of mine. And some of the five longest essays that are about writing specifically were responses to being invited to give a master class at NYU, which consisted really of me talking to the graduate students. It was not an interactive class. So for each of those, I wrote specifically to writers setting out or writers partly on their way, trying to be as helpful as I could.
Is it interesting to you to find themes, to put things together in those headings that may be as simple as writers or visual artists?
That was tough. Organizing the book was tough. I didn't want huge blocks on one subject. I wanted to punctuate the writing advice sorts of essays with the only essays on visual arts I've written. Then I debated about some which crossed over into the sort of the genre of memoir. I thought, I don't want to go too far into this genre because maybe I want to have a book later on that is all memoir. But some sit right on the line, so that was tough.
Are you comfortable writing about yourself, things that happened to you?
I am comfortable, but again, I try to be careful to distinguish what is only of interest to me and what it will be of interest to other people also, you know, either chime with their experiences or just be written in such a way that they can enjoy it.
And when you talk about things that are of interest to you, does that come through? It would seem that comes through in the writers that you choose to write about and the visual artists that you choose to write about.
Yeah, it does. Anything I write, I want to spring from my own interest. So that's absolutely the case with usually the essay was written in response to an invitation, but I wouldn't have picked up on the invitation if I hadn't felt some interest of my own.
Right. I'm assuming you get a lot of invitations that you say no to.
I do. I do get a lot of invitations to write forewords and introductions and so on. And sometimes I have to turn them down even when I am interested in the writer because of lack of time. I just tend to pile up projects in front of myself. And the latest one often comes along to push the others out of the way. And it's a large list now.
This may seem like an obvious question or an odd question. I don't know. You can determine, which is it difficult or is there a difference? Let's put it that way. Is there a difference in writing about visual art as compared to writing about writers? And I ask the question specifically because of what you just said. I mean, obviously, you're much more comfortable. You are a writer, so I would think that would be more in the wheelhouse.
Yes, I can write fluently, or I don't know how to say it. I have plenty to say about a piece of visual art, but the difference is that I'm writing about it from the outside. I'm facing it and talking about what I see, and then what I have stored in my brain, which is limited about art and about how to look at visual art and about the artist in particular. Whereas when I'm writing about writing, of course, I'm from deep inside it and having been inside it for so many decades. So it's a very, very different endeavor.
in my questioning, I realize that I've used the word comfortable a lot. Do you think writers are ever truly comfortable?
Yes. I'm very comfortable writing. And I'll say that because what you write at home or wherever you write is not immediately going into print unless that is your form, tweeting or something. But when I write, it's always in a very relaxed place, and I don't have to publish it if I'm not happy with it.
In talking about visual artists, there is a piece in the new book about early tourist photographs. How did that particular assignment come about?
Well, that one wasn't an assignment. That was me discovering these photos just by chance. They were the photos of the ancestor of a friend of mine. And she knew I was interested in Dutch culture and Dutch literature. And she said, well, here are some photos that I have that were taken from some early trip. We had a lot of trouble figuring out what year the trip might have been. And I was so struck and so just charmed by these photos, and I still am. They don't lose their charm for me, that I wanted to write about them. And I did a sort of portfolio of them for the Paris Review, in which I introduced them and then described them or captioned them. And that's how they came into being.
It's always difficult to talk about the visual on the radio, but there is a beautiful photograph of a girl with an umbrella. You write and you talk about the elegance of that child.
Yes, and then the Paris Review did agree to, I said, why don't you put her on the cover of that issue? And they did agree to do it because she's so, it's not just that it's something about the way she's standing and holding herself that's elegant, but she also has a look. She's a child of about 11, I'm guessing. She has a look of sort of slight challenge or haughtiness, or there's a lot of character in her expression. I just thought it was fantastic.
There is a picture of a little boy there, too, that you say is one of the most stereotypically Dutch of the images. He's a child, but he looks like a bruiser.
Yes, it's again the way he's standing. He's standing very frontally facing the camera, and he's very thickly clothed and has thick wooden clogs on. But he's also, because of the angle of the camera, he's also gigantic compared to the background, which is small houses sort of below him. Mm. So he looks like a little giant boy.
Lydia Davis is our guest on the book show. The name of the new collection is Essays 1. It is published by FSG. I am hoping that you can read for us a portion of one of the essays. And I assume that this is what you were talking about earlier of autobiographical would be a part of a memoir.
Yes, I hesitated over whether to put this one in. It's called Meeting Abraham Lincoln. And it is autobiographical, but it's also really a comment on how history is formed or how stories are handed down to us. And so I thought it sort of paired up pretty well with the last essay in the book called Remember the Van Wagenens, which is all about memory and impressions that become memories and that sort of thing. It's in several sections, but I'll read part of the first, and that's the opening. At a gathering just after Christmas last year, someone brought up the idea of how many handshakes might separate you from a famous person. That is, you might have shaken the hand that shook the hand that shook the hand of Muhammad Ali. It's a nice idea. It makes you feel close to greatness or close to someone who otherwise would be very distant in time or in personal fame. I then told my story about Abraham Lincoln and shook the hand of each person standing in the small circle near a very broad fireplace with a hearth of worn, uneven bricks. We were in a house whose age is hard to pinpoint exactly because of the contradictory architectural features, but that was built sometime between 1790 and 1830. I told them they were shaking the hand that shook the hand that shook the hand that shook the hand of Abraham Lincoln. I can say that I am only three handshakes away from Lincoln, although it would be more accurate to say one handshake and two hand clasps, since I did not shake but clasped my mother's hand for 57 years that I knew her, and she did not shake but clasped her great-grandfather's hand for the 14 years that she knew him. He was the one who shook Lincoln's hand, traveling to Springfield, Illinois, to do so. But there are at least four somewhat differing accounts of this event, which makes you wonder about the accuracy of any historical account. Clearly, the meeting with Lincoln is something that certain members of my family have been proud of ever since it happened, but no one has it quite the same. Even old Grandpa Bent, the man who shook the great hand, may have had some of it wrong. My mother's was probably the hand I held most often during certain years of my life, first when my hand was small and hers was larger, and last when she was often lying in her bed and I was sitting beside her, her hand softer and weaker and more crooked than mine. She herself held many hands when she was a little girl because she was born into a family of three older brothers and an older sister, as well as her widowed mother, many aunts and uncles, two grandparents, and two great-grandparents. Upon the death of her great-grandmother, when my mother was 3 years old, her family moved into the large house of her great-grandfather Bent, and beginning at that time, the old man, though he could be hard-hearted and mean-spirited, no doubt often held her hand, even kindly.
Lydia Davis reading a portion of Meeting Abraham Lincoln from the new collection, Essays 1, published by FSG. My understanding is that the second collection of essays will mostly have to do with translation.
Yes, translation and learning foreign languages, because that's been something that I've been doing sort of intensively over the last, say, 20 years, or even less, maybe, 10, 15 years. So there's a long essay about learning Spanish, a long one about learning Dutch, and a long one about learning Norwegian. And since I'm working right now on editing this book, I'm trying to make sure, and I think successfully, that those three are not too repetitious over the course of the book. And I wrote them at widely differing times, so I think my approach was different. But yes, a lot of the rest of the book are essays about translation.
What initially caught your attention and your interest in translation?
Well, I might have to go back to early childhood, but I trace it back psychologically anyway, emotionally, to a classroom in Austria when I was seven. I was put into the Ursulinen Klosterschule by my parents without any previous coaching in German and really asked to sink or swim. And I swam after a while. It took me about a month, I think, to get comfortable in the German language as it was spoken to children. But I think that planted the obsession, perhaps, with, you know, wanting to know what they're saying and then wanting to put it into English.
That idea of sinking or swimming seems terrifying, especially for someone so young.
I would think so. Particularly since my mother was very ill at the time and so on. So there must have been all sorts of chaos going on. But the memories are happy of that school. And I think that the other children were very welcoming, which makes a huge difference, of course. So they were welcoming. The teacher was welcoming. So I've had very happy memories of learning German, even though I think the German language is problematic.
You have said that your earliest memories of reading involve the Dick and Jane books.
Yes. Again, very happy. You know, in later years, I would hear people complain about how dull they were. And you know, we must have more interesting readers for children, which I guess we do now. But I loved them because the excitement, I didn't care if the story was boring. You know, look, Jane, look, see the ball. I didn't care that that was boring, because what was exciting was learning to read and learning the words, what they were.
There's also a neatness to it that you seem to cherish in your work.
There's a neatness and a clarity of that experience. And I imagine that I don't really remember the teachers and the teaching of those books, but I imagine they were very competent, organized teachers. And it was a quiet classroom. It was not a chaotic, difficult classroom.
One of my favorite parts of this book, you write about the revising of one sentence. That is very instructive. But I assume to do it is one thing. To write about it and to deconstruct it would be quite another.
Yes. That was also born of my teaching situation, my teaching. I tended to get very involved in my teaching of the classes, probably every one. So when I was at home in the evening between classes, I would sometimes see something, spot something that would be very helpful to the students. And so I would take off on it. And this was born of that. I thought, okay, I just observed how I revised this sentence. I will type it out, the process, for the class. And I did that, but you're right, it was very laborious. And it was very laborious to revise this account of revising the sentence.
Well, that's interesting. What was laborious about that? Because had the process changed?
No, it was more how to lay it out, how to clarify that this attempt came before this next attempt, and you know, just how to lay it out on the page so that it was really clear.
When it comes to you revising, you do that, I assume, really without thinking. And this is a deep dive into what is happening. I was interested in the fact that a notebook was often employed in the revising of a sentence.
Well, the notebook would often be the place where the sentence was first written down. And then the notebook would be where I read it again later and thought to myself, this isn't quite right, and began to revise it. So it takes place in the notebook, even if I'll never use that sentence.
And famously, of course, for you, a sentence can be a short story.
Yes.
So that even increases the importance of that sentence being revised and to your liking.
Yes, it's really crucial. If all you have is a line or two in the title, they've got to be exactly the way they should be, in your opinion. Whereas if that sentence is in the middle of a 350-page novel, it can be not such a wonderful sentence. You know, you can easily get away with that.
Mm-hmm. In getting away with it, I'm curious as to, because there can be a process where you could pore over every sentence.
Oh, I think ideally I would. I really don't think I would ever leave a really sloppy sentence in the middle of a large novel. But I have read wonderful novels that have sloppy writing in them, and they're still wonderful because of many other things, the characters, the plot, and so on.
You have only written one novel.
Yes.
Is that something that you would go back to, or that you did as a test, or how did that come about?
I wouldn't go back to it. I think it's fine the way it is, even though I don't think of myself as a novelist. The way it happened was that I had a story to tell, and I realized after a while, especially after I began writing little passages that might go into the story, that this was going to be a long story. And so this novel really is just a long story. It's sort of composed somewhat the same way I would compose a long story that remained a story. But this one had to be a novel.
When you think of your influences, I mean, obviously we mentioned the Dick and Jane books, but when you think of the writers and the influences that have had deep resonance with you, do we read about them in this book? Do we read about them in your work?
Well, you do, yes. You really do in this book, because when I was preparing the talks for the master classes, I did want to describe my own development. That became a running theme, but it wasn't to be all about me. It was to be about writing. So I wanted to talk about the writers that were examples for me, or models, like Kafka and Beckett, and later Jane Bowles, and other essays in the book that I have a foreword to Lucia Berlin's stories. They came along too late to be really influences, but they were writers that I admired. So her writing, and I'm trying to think of some of the others, Ray Armantrout's poetry, they're writings that I can return to again and again and find great satisfaction in.
You also address in this book reading. I believe it is in 30 recommendations for good writing habits that you ask the question of how should you read, what should the diet of your reading be? And for writers, that is important. Those are important questions to ask and answer.
Yeah, I think I particularly wanted to emphasize that because I was getting the impression, and I think rightly, that a lot of young writers are reading a great deal of contemporary writing, but really not reading a great deal of older excellent writing, or even older strange writing. So that becomes a sort of a self-contained system. You know, we're living in this age, and then writers who write about this age, it's a little too concentratedly on this age. I think they need to read, you know, Lawrence Stern or John Donne or Shakespeare or Conrad or Fenimore Cooper. I can go on and on and on and on.
Give us an example of strange writing.
Oh, well, a line of Shakespeare you wouldn't think would be strange, but I think he's actually strange, probably all over the place. But it was, and I can't quote it exactly, but it was something like, it's the daughter Regan talking about her father's madness, but saying, if I said it in modern terms, it would be saying, well, he never really was very good at knowing himself. But she says something like, he ever but slenderly knew himself. So I find that slenderly very odd.
Well, the new collection is Essays 1. It is absolutely beautiful. It is out from FSG. Lydia Davis, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Lydia Davis's new collection is Essays 1. It is published by FSG. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.